Hi everyone, welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Werkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we'll be talking about movies from 2025, catching up last week from our coverage of Almost Famous from 2000. It's been, well, I guess we'll talk about how it's been so far this year in Q1 of 2025. We cover the Oscars, and then we take a break. So that gives us some time to catch up on some new movies. I will say that I have not seen that many this year. There are some streaming, there are some out in theaters, and there are some really big ones doing really well. Each year, I would say Q1 is normally shaky in terms of best of the year or biggest of the year. We do see some that carry out, but that's pretty rare. And I think we're seeing similar things so far this year. But how has your movie-going experience gone so far in 2025?
It's funny because I think what you said is exactly true. You know, we spend so much of the early part of the year covering the Oscars, doing our contender series, and rewatching or completing our lists for the Oscar ceremony, whether it's checking out the documentary features, watching all of the shorts, going back to some of the big ones so we can pick the Oscar scenes for our acting nominees. That fills up a lot of our time. And then I noticed yesterday that it was the anniversary of Challengers. It had been 1 year since Challengers came out. And I thought, okay, you know, we're not in a bad place because I remember last year thinking, when is a good movie going to come out? When will I be really excited about a movie again? And then Challengers hit and I was instantly obsessed. It was all I could talk about for months. And I realized, okay, that came in April. And then later on in the year, we had so many films that I did really love from that year. So I think it's always a little tough at the beginning of the year. But we did have two movies in particular that I think are really successful. Sinners, we will spend, I think, most of the time today talking about that movie. I have loved the response to that so far and how into it people are. They're going to see it in IMAX. They're sharing the score and how much they love that as the new music to listen to. And I also will say that 2025, while I have started to catch up on a lot of the movies that I missed, I was also so painfully addicted to The Pit on Max. And I watched a lot of TV. So I think I spent a lot of time also catching up on shows, kind of mixing it up a little bit. But I'm back in the movie mood. I'm really excited, I think, for what's to come. And I'll say, for me, Black Bag and Sinners in particular kind of re-energized me a little bit with new movies this year.
Yeah, I was only in planning for this episode and knowing that I wanted to say more than a few things about maybe a couple movies that I said, okay, maybe I should catch up on some movies, whether I like it or not. There's plenty of drama that we'll talk about, but I did also like, so I saw Black Bag. That was such a fun time. Sinners, absolutely loved, and I am so excited we'll be spending most of the time today on that. And then I saw Andrew Ahn's remake of Ang Lee's The Wedding Banquet, which I thought was very cute and just captured everything that he does in his movies. So we can talk about those a little bit. I know we have some big Oscar updates that they've made to new categories and category changes and how we see certain things based on how this past year went with award season. So if you want to go through those, that'll be, I think, an interesting way to start.
Yeah, I think first maybe let's talk about the new categories. Then we'll get into some of the rule changes around how members should participate. But the Academy did create a new award for achievement in stunt design. I think people have been wanting this for a really long time. The work of stunt designers has gone really unrecognized when it comes to the Oscars. And this is some of the, I think, most exciting work, really, especially as we look at action films, franchise films. When you think of even Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning coming out this summer and premiering at Cannes, this work, I think, is something that people have wanted to see celebrated for a long time. And this will start at the 100th Oscars, so in 2028. So the first crop of films that will be recognized in this category will be those that come out in 2027. And then we also have a brand new achievement in casting category. We will actually see this year. So we'll cover it this year. We'll have a contender series about it, which I'm really excited for. But we also learned that this was going to be a shortlist category. So we would get to see a shortlist with 10 films, and they will also have a bake-off. So we talk about the bake-offs in some of our technical categories like makeup and hair, styling, visual effects, where the branch gets together and you get to see a presentation by all of the shortlisted contenders. So I'm excited to hear what the casting directors will put together as part of these achievements. It'll also include a Q&A, so I'm excited to just hear more about that. And of course, you know, my first thought, because it's me and I love the films of Paul Thomas Anderson, is how could that film not be recognized here? I feel like the casting is going to be amazing, but I digress.
I think in terms of these two and categories, it'll be interesting to see where award season takes us with these. And because they're so new, how they're formed or what threads we start to see in their first few years. And then also how they connect to other ceremonies where we already have these categories. So I'm curious if, you know, we're going to see those things where it won here, so it'll probably win the Oscar, or if things are going to be original enough that it'll be fun to play along with. I think that's what we look for on the podcast and in conversations, is, you know, really trying to put together some fun winners to see, some more original thinking, I will just say, from year to year. So yeah, I think these are categories people are excited for, and I'm curious to see how they kind of shape award season and movie making in the future.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Like, will the SAG stunt ensemble nominees translate to the Oscars, or will the BAFTA casting nominations and the winner there translate to Oscar? I think it's possible, but it's uncharted territory for the Academy. And speaking of just new changes to categories, I'm sure you loved this one too, but we're getting a cinematography shortlist.
Absolutely.
I can't wait to just see what's included, because that branch tends to go their own way sometimes. I mean, we can look to things like the British Society of Cinematographers or the American Society of Cinematographers, but they have some creative nominees every so often. So I'm really excited to see that shortlist. And then another thing that I just thought was kind of funny, truly, was around the AI of it all. So last year, of course, there was a great brouhaha over the use of AI, or however it was used, in films like The Brutalist or Emilia Perez. I think especially the use of AI in The Brutalist was something that a lot of people online latched onto because they wanted a different outcome, specifically in the Best Actor race. But it didn't work. Anyway, the Academy had an update, and it is, I think, very vague, and I don't really know if it matters at all. But they said, with regard to generative artificial intelligence and other digital tools used in the making of the film, the tools neither help nor harm the chances of achieving a nomination. The Academy and each branch will judge the achievement, taking into account the degree to which a human was at the heart of the creative authorship when choosing which movie to award. So that kind of seems like a whole lot of nothing, but I think they felt the need to respond after what seemed like a targeted campaign. But I will also say that that campaign was coming from a lot of people who were not Academy members, so they can't exactly really enforce this with online stan culture.
Yeah. It sounds more like a warning than an actual guideline. Like, who will be enforcing this? Like, yes, the branch and the Academy, but it comes down to the members who nominate or make the list of nominations to begin with. So who is the one saying, okay, this had so much percentage of AI use and this one didn't? Like, yeah, it sounds like a slap on the wrist, which is fine, I guess, that they've acknowledged something, which they don't always do. I like that our final new rule update, we can call it the Kirsten Dunst update because we love her, is that now also because of this, I think of what we hear from voters and, you know, people voting for their friends, whether that be from the anonymous ballots or wherever they come from, but they're saying that all voters now must watch all the nominated films in each category to be eligible to vote in the final round for the Oscars. why have they not been doing this all along? I don't know, but it's, I would say, I think for both of us, a necessary update to the voting process to make sure everything is fair. You've seen everything and we can trust that you have. Again, how they enforce this, I don't know.
It does seem like kind of an administrative nightmare to track all of this, just because if you go to an in-person screening, you do have to fill out a form later that tells the Academy what screening you went to, when you saw it, the location, the film. So that makes me wonder, like, if an Academy member just goes to, I don't even know if they do this, I'm sure they do, but if they go, like, on Thanksgiving to see a movie with their family at, who knows, the Vista, does that not count? It has to, right? There has to be a way, I think, to make that count. But then I think this also is in line with the Academy moving to their digital portal,
right,
where they watch all of the movies. So they can track there if they've completed the film in their screener portal, which I also just think is interesting, like imagining Faye Dunaway forcing her assistant to watch all of the movies or something like that. But I do think in practice, it could eliminate big sweeps. I don't know. I mean, if someone really likes a film, then they're always just going to vote for it no matter what. But it'll be interesting to see, I think, how it changes the results at the end of the day. Or maybe voter turnout will be lower because of it. But yes, everyone should follow Kirsten Dunst, her lead, when she said, of course, I watch all of the movies. I'm a member of the Academy.
I'm hoping in the end, this all just helps our shorts predictions.
Yes. Oh, those shorts, they will always be the thorn in my side when it comes to predicting.
Right. So getting into 2025 movies, I think let's just start off with Sinners, the big one that everyone is talking about. I've loved all of the videos from Ryan Coogler talking about the different aspect ratios, hearing friends going to see this multiple times, hearing about what they found on second viewings in terms of themes and images, motifs that he uses to either differentiate characters like the Michael B. Jordan twins, or the fact that this movie now has had the smallest second weekend drop ever for an R-rated film.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's made $161 million globally, $122 million domestically, and it dropped 6% this past weekend, I think making around $45 million, which is insane. And that's exciting for movie going and for just really good blockbusters or great storytellers in general. I love seeing movies like this, and it was such an exciting experience.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Sinners, and I'm so excited people are seeing it. What's really cool about it too is that friends, coworkers, they're all really excited about Sinners. And one of my coworkers, he said, I see movies in IMAX because I have AMC A-List, and this is the first time I actually feel like I need to recommend seeing a movie in IMAX to people. So I think that's a really cool thing about this movie, is people are checking it out in different formats, seeing it in 70mm IMAX. If you have the ability to see it in that format, I highly recommend it. There's also a great video from the BFI that I just watched of them loading the print, and it's just really cool, very nerdy. But if you haven't seen it yet, we will do a quick spoiler-free review. Brief description here: trying to leave their troubled lives behind, twin brothers Smoke and Stack return to their hometown of Clarksdale, Mississippi to start again, only to discover that an even greater evil is waiting to welcome them back. This was, as you said, directed by Ryan Coogler and stars a pretty fantastic ensemble cast, including Michael B. Jordan, Miles Caton, Jack O'Connell, Wunmi Musaku, Haley Steinfeld, Delroy Lindo, Omar Benson Miller, and more. So you mentioned that you really loved Sinners. I'll say that what I really liked about it just at the top is that it really takes its time to get you acclimated to the world of the film. That's something I always like, admittedly. It's when a director really takes their time setting the world up. But I like here how we spend about 40 to 45 minutes really getting to know these two brothers, really getting to know this world of Clarksdale, Mississippi, why they may have returned, because they're coming from Chicago. They've decided that they're going to come back to their hometown. They're going to open this juke joint. And also their cousin Sammy, who is an aspiring musician. He has a really incredible voice. But how blues music is incorporated into the narrative. This film starts in a really horrifying way, I think, but it doesn't give you a lot of information before it jumps back to the day before. So Coogler takes his time really orienting you with this world specifically. You get to know the characters. You get to know the little idiosyncrasies of the time and the period and exactly what they're dealing with here. It's the Jim Crow South, and before the vampires or that supernatural horror is introduced, you get the idea of them, you know, returning to the devil they know in many ways, right? You think of it as, why would they leave Chicago to go back to Mississippi at this time? This section of the movie, I think, really introduces that idea in a very smart way before everything goes to hell and back, I would say.
Yeah, I like the movie for similar reasons. I think in the beginning, while we're having that exposition, getting to know these characters, it's also a Western. And I will say, in just watching movies so far this year, I've seen maybe a few from 2025, but way too many to count from the past. And I've actually started to enjoy Westerns.
Oh my God.
Which is a new thing. Yes, thank you.
This is a new thing.
Thank you, Sergio Leone and Clint Eastwood. And John Wayne and John Ford, Howard Hawks. But anyway, this intro just feels so much like those old Westerns. And that made me so happy because it tells you about a real time in the South in America in the 1930s that, you know, even just seeing TikToks about this, of how Chinese store owners supported Black people because of segregation. And they went to their stores, and, you know, we have a scene of that in this movie where they go to the Chow's store to buy all of this food for their opening night later. And the other part about the intro that I like is that we see Sammy walking into this church not knowing anything at this point. He drives up, he walks in with this broken guitar. What has happened? He's bloody, he's got scratches on his face. And his dad is the pastor. Everyone's in beautiful white clothing. And then it goes a day ago. And you're like, how did this all happen in a day? So I think all of those storytelling tactics of setting us up for this exciting something, you really get invested with these characters, like you're saying. And you start to see differences between Smoke and Stack or how they're meeting with Hogwood was so important. And color plays a big deal in this. And then we start to get into the thriller, part horror, once we're introduced to Remick, played by Jack O'Connell. I love that he's just steaming. His body is steaming. And all of this is just tied to lore from the past. So it's cool to go through those layers and uncover all of this knowledge that Ryan Coogler is filling this movie with. But also just getting to live in this world and understanding what drives these people to happiness or what separated them. Like how Smoke comes back to Annie and we learn about how she works with herbal medicine. So yeah, I think there's a lot we can dive into. What were your favorite aspects of the movie or later on characters, scenes?
Yeah, it's hard, I think, because we want to do this spoiler-free, just not to go too far in depth into some of these things, because you really could talk about this movie for hours. I think in particular, what I really loved about this movie is that I love the Southern Gothic novel and literary tradition. Just learning about it, I think, is really fascinating. And when you look at Southern Gothic literature, you see these, you know, pretty disturbing characters that pop up for a variety of reasons. There's a lot of violence and there's also a lot of decay that's happening. Death and decay is really important to the Southern Gothic novel. And I could feel Ryan Coogler playing with that. And he's also at the same time livening it up with this idea around the musical mythology that he wants to look into. and really deeply investigate. And I think when we talk about modern horror directors, we obviously talk about Jordan Peele, but we also talk about Robert Eggers. And I think Robert Eggers rightfully gets a lot of credit for how well researched his movies are and just how much detail we see in films like Nosferatu or The Witch, where they feel just ripped from that period. And I felt that same exact thing from Sinners, yet I also felt that he was injecting new life into it at every turn, making it totally his own and making it feel really original. And I think that I saw that most when he was talking about and thinking about music. In particular, there's a moment when Delta Slim, the Delroy Lindo character, who's another musician, he says, "See, white folks, they like the blues just fine. They just don't like the people who make it." And that's this idea, I think, where if you look at music history, if you look at rock and roll, if you look at metal, if you look at anything that exists today, a lot of white artists took from the blues directly. They co-opted it. They made it for them without honoring that tradition. And I think Coogler is directly playing with that idea. And there's this great scene when they open the juke joint later in the film that directly blurs the line between past, present, and future. I think it's a scene that might catch people by surprise. I really haven't seen much like it in film before. I think it reminded me actually of like a dream ballet, like in The Red Shoes. That was probably the closest comparison I could think of just in a film like that that plays with fantasy. He's playing with different styles of music that all come from black musicians playing with the blues. And I was just pretty floored by that. And this is all before the vampires even appear.
Yeah.
So it just feels like this like rich meal of a movie. There's just so much to get out of it, I think, at every turn. And then when we do finally get into that violence and the grotesque part of it with these vampires, I love the idea of how Coogler plays with one of the core, you know, tenets of vampire tradition, which is that you have to invite them in. There are just so many ideas in this movie to unpack, and it's why I think I'm so eager to see it again, too. Mm-hmm.
That scene, that music scene, is my favorite in the movie. It also feels like something where Ryan Coogler will come out and say, yeah, the studio didn't want that, but I really wanted that scene in, kind of like the bus stop scene in Barbie. Like, there is so much power in that moment that sums up the entire movie without having to say too much. And that's what I loved about it. And also here with that aspect ratio, if you're seeing the movie in IMAX or one of those bigger IMAX formats, 70 millimeter, the screen opens when they start to dance. And it just feels like you're being invited in and you're experiencing this almost firsthand. Everything is so rich. There's this mystical and religious quality that you feel throughout the film, but especially here because we're playing with past, present, and future of black music, of the blues, of rap, and of these creatures or masks that I don't understand, but it gives this sense that everyone is connected and it's because of the music. And you feel everyone moving together and just have so much joy and power in that experience together. And the camera opens up to the heavens and yeah, the movie continues, but it feels like it's on a different plane now. And so I was just really vibing with this section and that he took it somewhere again, going from a Western to this to thriller that I was absolutely not expecting. And I'm so glad that he did.
Again, there's just so much we could talk about here because it just is such a layered world. And he really is. And I don't mean this in a negative way at all. I think this is what I like about the movie is he's throwing everything into it. I think that he can and that he wants to. And that's what I really connected with. I was never once bored by this movie at all. I think I was just so wrapped up in every character, in knowing, I think, also how horrifying it could possibly get. I loved Annie. the character you were talking about earlier, and just her, all of her herbal medicines and her approach to the world. Because also, as someone who believes in all of this stuff, not necessarily vampires, but just that kind of, you know, supernatural thing and that type of evil, I just fully trusted in her. Mm-hmm. I thought, you are the only one who can save them from this.
Yeah. My favorite characters were played by Delroy Lindo, like you said, Delta Slim. I think his, just seeing him again, realizing mm-hmm. I hadn't seen him since Defy Bloods, made me really happy. But his character, being an alcoholic and this blues player, his scene with Sammy, they just immediately had so much chemistry. And you could feel his age and what he had gone through just by his diction and how he treated Sammy. And when he heard his music, was taken so aback. There was just something in the way that he carries himself that I absolutely loved. Also, mm-hmm. Miles Catton, you said, had a beautiful voice. And when he sings, they have this really beautiful scene together also in the car as they're driving through the cotton fields. And there's trauma in Delta Slim's voice and eyes. And they just turn that moment into music. And it's so beautiful. I also loved Annie. Mary, Haley Steinfeld, had some absolutely insane lines that I will not be repeating here today. I'm sorry.
Not like you did with Selena Gomez and Emilia Perez.
It's basically that, but hearing it in a packed screen, not like a small matinee screening with like 10 people, but like hundreds of people, you're just aghast and you hear everybody laughing around you. It's a totally different experience, but it's hilarious. And she carries herself as she has to not make that comedy. And that, I think, is what also drew me into those moments with her. And I love Cornbread, played by Omar Benson Miller. I think I first saw him in The Miracle of St. Anna's, which I loved growing up. But he's so good at comedy. And again, the switches that these actors have to go through in this movie, depending on where they are or what's happening, is really interesting. So he plays with characters so well. Yeah, it's how they all interact in this juke joint together that I think brings the movie together. And then through the end of the movie, again, no spoilers, but I realized I was like clenching my hands for nearly the final 30 minutes. And I'm like, I need a break. It's so good. Like, I don't want a break, but my body needs to de-stress.
Yeah. I will say I loved the ending and my theater was getting so into it, which is just such a fun mm-hmm. experience. People were cheering and clapping as it was ending, which I loved. So again, highly recommend this movie. I think it's just this beautiful mix of historic Southern Gothic meets revisionist history that is just so fun and fully realized. And I don't know, it's the one movie I think this year that I just keep thinking about and mm-hmm. keep turning over in my mind thinking, okay, I can't wait to see that again. And I find myself recommending it to a lot of people and just not saying much. I just say, okay, go see it and let me know what you think.
I told my brother-in-law to go see it and he kind of felt bad because it was horror a little and my sister is not so inclined. But it's just so much more than that. And I guess I really am not thinking, but I'm telling people the same thing. Like, I didn't know much going into it. And I think that's why I also really enjoyed it, because I didn't know what to expect. I will say, if you're going to see it, which you should, stay through the end credits. There are two credit scenes, one in the middle, one at the end. The middle one, I think, is really good. It is sort of like an epilogue to the story that made me think that this could have been a true story. And mm-hmm. so that is really interesting, talking about certain characters and where they end their story. And then the final scene I didn't stay for, but I heard can change how you kind of see the movie ending and what that meant for the Sammy character in the film as we see him the day after.
Mm. Well, I kind of love it. And I think that this is Coogler, a Marvel veteran, his little wink at his previous work. He's saying, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to incorporate some credits, credit scenes, mm-hmm. and just see what they can do. Because they're not fun fan winks. they recontextualize what you've seen and give you a different understanding, I think, of the film. So I love that he did that.
This is how they're supposed to be done, I'll say.
So if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
I think it might be director for Cooler because of the story he's telling with the specific vision. He also wrote the movie, so I think that goes hand in hand of him envisioning this as he's writing it. But I think it just is a splendid, spectacular, jaw-dropping experience that we should be talking about for many months to come. Hopefully it's one of those movies that we can talk about later this year. But it is, by and large, my favorite movie of the year so far. So that's why I will give it to him. What Oscar would you give it?
I considered a few. We didn't talk about the score, which I think is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. I love this score and can see myself listening to it over and over. This is Ludvig Göransson, who won the Academy Award for Black Panther and for Oppenheimer recently. So I think he's just one of the biggest names working right now, and the score is pretty incredible. But I will also give it to Ryan Coogler for directing. I feel like he had just such a broad canvas and feels so, I think, in control of it the entire time. I wouldn't call this a precise movie by any nature. Like, it doesn't feel like one of those types of like Todd Field Tar, like everything is in its right place types of movies. But I think it's better for it. I think the fact that he has so much going on and there are so many different ideas, so many characters and themes that he's incorporating just makes it that much richer. So I would go with Coogler here.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of Oscar potential. I love that the score feels like this rock musical almost, and how he plays with horror with that. I immediately downloaded the soundtrack when it came out.
Yeah, I hope that it gets recognized throughout the year. I will keep championing it. I think also in some tech categories. I loved Autumn Durald's Arkapaz cinematography also. And we rarely see women recognized in that category too. So I hope she at least makes the shortlist since we have one of those this year, like we mentioned. But yeah, go see Sinners. I know it's only the spring, but I think this has potential to hopefully have some legs as we head into the next month. I think our other two that we really liked, we mentioned The Wedding Banquet and Black Bag. I will let you take the lead on The Wedding Banquet, and I'll go with Black Bag, which is another favorite of mine from this year. This was directed by Steven Soderbergh and is a spy thriller meets domestic drama, I will call it. It's a movie about marriage and relationships. It stars Michael Fassbender, Kate Blanchett, Naomi Harris, Marissa Bella, Tom Burke, a really incredible cast. And I loved this so much. It reminded me so much of a 60s spy thriller or a John le Carré novel. It was just fun. I realized watching it that I think I like my thrillers without much action. I think I like the action to be set at home or in the office through really cutting lines and diabolical games at the dinner table. I had so much fun with this, though.
I didn't know it was going to be a murder mystery type of movie. Like, I get the Mr. and Mrs. Smith comparisons, and we have two amazing actors playing those roles also here. I love all of the conniving and the clues, the spy work that they do that we get to see a little bit of, but how that all comes out at the dinner table, and that house was built specifically for Soderbergh because of his movements, what that camera needs to be capturing. He uses some great angles there. But yeah, it comes down to the dialogue and how piercing Cate Blanchett can be, or how menacingly ambiguous Michael Fassbender could be responding to her. So watching them act together and everyone else, I loved seeing Marissa Abella at the table in this drama, getting her seat. So yeah, this was very fun. Definitely better than I expected.
I was so happy for Marissa Abella. She's one of our favorites from industry, where she's just amazing as Yaz in that show. And I feel like here she got to play with that same sexiness, but a different type of humor, which I appreciated. For me, she totally stole the show. And to do that in a movie where Cate Blanchett is present, you know, that is a tall order for me, but she was, I think, the one I really just loved watching throughout. But I also just really enjoyed how it was this, you know, tale of commitment and deception between this married couple and all of the little odes to spy movies that have come before. Did you see the Pigeon Tunnel at New York Film Festival when it was there?
Yeah.
I really liked that documentary, and I thought a lot about when John Le Carré was talking in that about his relationship with his father and how that affected a lot of his writing. There's a little detail even thrown in about George Woodhouse's relationship with his dad here. I loved that. Also just great editing done by Steven Soderbergh himself under a pseudonym, of course, but there is a really fantastic scene with a lie detector. So I also highly recommend going to see this one. I don't think it's really in many theaters anymore. It's on VOD though, so you can rent it at home.
And we just talked about, again, with Almost Famous, Steven Soderbergh had a double that year. He has a double this year. I haven't seen Presence, but have you seen that?
It's another great film of the year, I think. It's a really unique concept. Steven Soderbergh doesn't really do the same thing twice. He has themes he likes to work with, but he is, you know, he's a working director. He cranks them out. He is on budget and on time. And to get two very different films in the same year, I think just speaks to the type of director that he is. But I would say I would recommend Black Bag over Presence if I had to pick one.
Mm-hmm. I love that. During his press tour, he said, yeah, you should be able to make a 90-minute movie, and if you can't, you're not doing it right. So...
A hero among us.
We love our taut 90-minute thrillers or whatever they may be. Yeah, before I mention The Wedding Banquet, so this is a remake of Ang Lee's film of the same name, which I haven't seen but really need to. It has a similar story. So it is two gay couples living together. One is with Bowen Yang and Han Ji Chan, and then the other is Lily Gladstone and Kelly Marie Tran. And it's kind of a convoluted story in how Min, played by Ji Chan, marries Angela, played by Kelly Marie Tran, to get a green card to stay in the country so he doesn't have to go back to Korea to work for his family. His grandmother in the movie is played by Yoon Jung, who is my idol. She has just this beautiful conversation at one point with Min, but the convolution of the story also plays into the comedy of it, and it's part rom-com. These couples are having trouble in different ways that I think all play out together. It very much carries Andrew Ahn's style, and it really reminded me of his past Fire Island that I love so much, but in how the characters see each other and feel that community that is so important for them as a chosen family. And when the grandmother visits and they freak out and they think that her and her late husband, Min's grandparents again, are homophobic and weren't really supportive of him. And so to see them have those conversations once she finds out makes you really think about family in a different way and the importance of having those conversations and just understanding each other. I think there are a lot of cultures that sweep things under the rug and, you know, want to be seen in a certain way, don't want other people talking about their families. And that's something that their Korean family in the film brings. But that doesn't mean that's always how it has to be. So I think how all of these characters learn from each other is really important. And I think that's what made me feel so good watching this movie. It's very cathartic. It's funny. There were like three people in this movie theater when I went, but we were all laughing and you can hear sobs along the way, mostly coming from me, but I really did enjoy it. It's fun. It's funny. I would recommend it. I think it just has that warmth that we need in a smaller movie like this earlier in the year.
I would recommend it too. I just saw this past weekend and really enjoyed it. I also got really teary-eyed a few times. I was so excited to see Lily Gladstone again. Mm-hmm. She's just one of my favorite actresses working today. But for me, the stars of the show were Yoon Jung and Joan Chen. Anytime either of them were on screen, I just thought, do we take these actresses for granted?
Right.
Because, I mean, so much of it too. And Joan Chen is playing a very different kind of mother than she did in Dee Dee. But we talked a lot about how impactful her performance and that monologue was for us really in that movie. But here, her character starts out as being, you know, so painfully performative and self-absorbed to a comedic point, I think. And then later on, though, she has this really heartfelt conversation with her daughter, played by Kelly Marie Tran, where I just was like, ooh, the tears are coming. She's so good at those sorts of big emotional moments. And I think after speaking with her last year from Dee Dee and thinking about how she brought so much of her relationship with her own daughter into that movie, she nails it in these mom roles. I need more. And now it's to a point where I just know if I'm going to see her in a movie, I'm probably going to cry. And then Yoon Ye-jung, though, so much of her performance is just communicated with a look. She's not even speaking.
Yeah.
Sometimes she's on FaceTime or Zoom, and you're getting more out of her performance than you would from an actor in their biggest Oscar scene. There's just something about the subtlety, I think, of her performance that, again, just made me think of how much I loved her performance in Minari, too. How extraordinary I thought she was in that, and how she was really the heart of that film. But yeah, I loved the two of them, especially.
I totally agree. Oh, their scene at the dinner table was so good.
Yes. Oh, leftovers from the ceremony.
Yeah. So we both recommend these two. What are some other films that you saw that you liked that you would also maybe recommend to people?
Yeah. So these are some smaller films that are out right now that premiered at festivals last year and got, you know, delayed to 2025, or that haven't had a huge audience this year, but that I've really liked. I do still want to see The Ballad of Wallace Island with Carey Mulligan. I really want to see that. But I will recommend a few. So first, David Cronenberg's The Shrouds. I'm going to say to you, I don't think you would like this movie. I think especially with how you feel about some of Cronenberg's work. But I felt it was a very beautiful, odd meditation on grief. So if you like Cronenberg, if you like late era, late stage Cronenberg, highly recommend that. I also really loved this movie called The Friend, which I saw last year at New York Film Festival, but is out, I think, in limited theaters and should be out soon on streaming if it's not already. But this is with Naomi Watts and Bill Murray. And Naomi Watts plays this character named Iris, who has a perfect West Village apartment that is rent controlled but does not allow dogs. And she learns that she has been willed Bill Murray's character's huge Great Dane. It's just like a beautiful New York story. I really, really liked it. And if you're looking for just like an easy, heartwarming watch, if you also like dogs, if you like New York movies, I really recommend it. And also Paddington in Peru. So this came out in the UK in 2024, but in the US in 2025. And I don't think it's as good as Paddington 2, but I fully wept at the end of this movie. And it was very embarrassing. There's a small child with her mom next to me, and I was just trying not to make it very obvious that I was really crying. But I just love these movies. Olivia Colman is in it, and she's a wonderful addition to the Paddington universe. I think they should make 25 Paddington movies. Send him to any location. I will be there.
The next White Lotus is Paddington.
That's fine with me, truly. Paddington at the White Lotus.
I haven't seen any of those. Some of those are on my list. I do also really want to see The Ballad of Wallace Island. Most of what I saw is, yeah, they come from festivals in 2024. And one of those that I do really want to see is Ephes. That was at New York. And that is out, I think, limited now. Another that we talked about during award season in the international feature category was Armand, and that is now out also or streaming, but that's with Renata Reinsva, I think her second best performance after The Worst Person in the World. But this is another school drama that deals with their kids and what happens between the kids at school and how the parents and the teachers sort of figure this incident out. And I think she is phenomenal. Looking back through some other movies, I can't believe Companion came out this year. That feels like years ago at this point.
It does feel like years ago.
But I was not as high on that as maybe some others were. Again, there was an Oscar-nominated short that came out that I saw the day before that was very similar, and that kind of took me out. But I also saw The Parenting. That was an HBO release with some great actors. Like, it was so good to see Edie Falco back, and Brian Cox was in that. But then I kind of fell flat. Mickey 17, Bong Joon-ho's newest movie, I think is not his best. You see his themes, and I appreciate the Bong Joon-ho of it all, but I think there's some plot holes happening from the adaptation from the book that are hard to capture on screen, too. And in his caricatures of certain characters, like the Toni Collette and Mark Ruffalo couple, of this fascist, over-the-top regime, really, of how they run this ship is... You get what he's doing, but again, I think it's just a little off-putting or feels weird. So it wasn't a bad experience. It was just a different one to one that I expect from loving so many of his movies, like The Host and Parasite, obviously.
Yeah, I felt similarly about Mickey 17. I loved Robert Pattinson in it. I think he's pretty amazing, playing multiple characters, multiple roles. But I think... a problem that, you know, I admittedly brought to Mickey 17 is that I just loved Parasite so much. And I feel like Parasite's success is really in its precision. So when you have something like Mickey 17 that just feels like it's a little bit overstuffed, I think it's hard to get on its wavelength. So I just found some of the subplots to just kind of lead on a road to nowhere. And that's just not necessarily what I always expect from Bong Joon-ho. It reminded me of Okja. I think if I had to pick another Bong Joon-ho film that I felt similarly to. But yeah, I think there were definitely some things in it to watch. And I would say check it out if you're curious, for sure. It's just not at the top of my list like some of the others.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear what you thought of Drop, because I saw your 1-star Letterboxd rating. I haven't seen this yet. I do want to see it, though, because I saw the trailer about 1,000 times. So I'm curious.
I was so excited from the trailer. I said, this will be so much fun. And I wanted to leave within 10 minutes. I said, why am I here?
Oh, gosh.
It was just a mess. I truly don't know where to begin. I really wanted more from Megan Fahey. And what I thought would be this like mystery, murder mystery, like who is this person who can see her phone and her and is... kidnapping her son or trying to kill the babysitter, like, is she involved? But it just ends in this very weird way where you're not really given clues to find out who this person is. They just sort of tell you after a certain amount of time where nothing just seems to be working for her or in her favor. And I think the script was just so elementary. It just wasn't giving us much to work with.
I'm probably still going to watch it, maybe even more so now, just because I'm curious. Review.
Yeah, I feel like you'll laugh. Like, it's a funny experience, and I feel like it's one of those movies that shouldn't be.
Okay.
Because everyone is serious in this movie, even though there are some maybe comedic moments, but yeah, it was rough.
Speaking of things that are funny that aren't supposed to be funny, Snow White.
Oh, no.
Which I saw, and honestly, it was not as bad as I expected. I think with when, you know, some of the stills from the movie came out, people were ragging on it, thinking it was going to be really bad. And some of the Disney live action remakes aren't the best. But Rachel Zegler, I thought, was perfect in this movie. She has such an amazing voice. She's so cute in this role. I feel like she's born to play a Disney princess, really. And... so I have no complaints whatsoever about her. And the fact that the studio is blaming her for everything related to this movie is just appalling and annoying.
Yeah.
Gal Gadot, I really don't have the words for this performance. The songs, if the right person had this role, the songs could have been really campy think like campy diva, like drag anthems, honestly. Oh my God. But she just brings no life to them at all. So you're just left kind of laughing at this lifeless performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept thinking like, oh my God, if you put Anya Nerve from this season of Drag Race there, it's a good movie all of a sudden. Or Countess Luann for a Bravo reference, make her the evil queen.
Yeah.
You needed some sort of high drama and camp from that performance, and it was just not that. That flopped hard, and in comparison, I think, to what Rachel Zegler is doing, it's just a difficult one, for sure. But I think some of the reworking of the themes in the movie will appeal to a new generation of viewers. It has some good feminist themes in it, I think, but you really just can't get past the lack of life behind Gal Gadot's eyes.
Well, there was a video of all of the queens who perform in the drag, the musical on Broadway, and they were just all going around saying their favorite Gal Gadot lines, just of all time, God. But they repeat some from this movie. And I'm like, yeah, that's enough for me not to go see this.
I need to watch that video now, especially since thinking, I mean, Susie Toot would have wanted the role so badly too. Like, I could see that working for her. Anya Nerve would have been my choice, though.
Oh, that's so funny.
So what are some upcoming films, like from this spring or summer, that you're really excited for? Just looking at the year ahead, now that we've gotten Q1 behind us.
Well, I mean, we haven't even talked about some of the biggest movies of the year, but again, they're not for us. Like a Minecraft movie, it's made for kids. They should go see that and have fun. I heard the theater experiences there are pretty wild. We had Captain America, Brave New World, Dog Man. Again, things that have made a lot of money that, again, aren't for us. I would say moving forward, I did love A Simple Favor, but I'm scared that the sequel, Another Simple Favor, is going to bomb. I may watch that. I think that's going straight to Amazon Prime. I am so excited, and maybe take this with a grain of salt because of Drop, but Final Destination Bloodlines, the newest one in that saga. Also, I Know What You Did Last Summer. That as a sort of reboot that looks like Scream. I'll definitely watch that, but those both could be campy. I think my biggest one is Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so excited for what's going to happen, and the trailer looks absolutely insane. Just so many explosions, Tom Cruise jumping, soaring, doing who knows what. But they have more in the cast there. Vanessa Kirby and Hannah Waddingham will be there. Nick Offerman. I'm excited for whatever happens there. I'm sure we'll have a roundup sometime this summer to talk about more of these movies that are coming out. But what are some of your upcoming releases that you're excited for?
I think the big one that I'm really excited for is Celine Song's follow-up to Past Lives, Materialists. I wasn't sure, and I'm still not totally sure about the cast, about that trio. But I have to say, seeing the trailer in the theater multiple times now. So I went to see Pride and Prejudice in the theater for its 20th mm-hmm. anniversary. Highly recommend. Phenomenal experience. Cried. Was very moved, etc. One of my favorite films. But I've seen that trailer a few times now, and it just looks like the type of movie that I love. It reminds me of Nancy Meyers. I know I joked that the poster looked like early 2000s Woody Allen, but that's not necessarily a bad thing coming from me. And I don't know. I just love the idea of like Dakota Johnson as this matchmaker who's between two guys who are very different. That looks really good. And then I'm also excited for Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. There's something about when that trailer plays that just makes you think, like, movies are alive. Mm-hmm. I love going to the movies. So I can't wait for that. And I would also say I'm excited for Megan 2.0. Just looks silly and ridiculous. And on the same note, Freakier Friday, the sequel to Freaky Friday. We are in the low Renaissance. So I'm here for that, and I can't wait. I'm sure Jamie Lee Curtis is up to her typical antics, and maybe we can expect a Rogue Supporting Actress nomination for her somewhere this year.
Oh my God. She'll find a way. Yeah, I have a really exciting birthday this year. I have a double feature release day, Megan 2.0 and F1. So maybe we call it Megan 2.F1 or something. And
Megan
I'll go
F1.
See both on the same day. Yeah. I'm curious about the Brad Pitt movie because that's also Joseph Kaczynski. And that trailer does look really exciting. And I think the camera work, the sound work, editing could be around for a while. So we'll see about that movie as well. But lots of different types of movies, as always, coming very soon.
Yeah, I'm excited. And next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll be going back in time again, this time to 1955. And we will be talking about an actor who we shockingly have never discussed on Oscar Wilde. James Dean had two movies in 1955. He had East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause. So we're going to talk about one of, I think, our finest actors really in history. Just a charisma bomb and such an ultimate presence that was taken from us way too soon. So I'm really excited to talk about both of these movies and to talk about his very short but great career.
Absolutely. Well, thank you everyone for listening. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky, and TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. We have bonus content on our Patreon at patreon.com/OscarWilde.
Thanks everyone. We'll see you next time.